Vegetarian and vegan options are standard on restaurant menus these days. That was not the case decades ago. And one book sits at the center of generational change in food and eating, Francis Moore LePage's Diet for a Small Planet. First published in 1971, it promoted a plant-centered approach to promote healthy people and a healthier planet. And since then, Diet for a Small Planet has sold 3.5 million copies and gone through 10th and 20th anniversary editions. And for the new 50th anniversary version, we have Francis Moore LePage on the line. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
And joining us is her daughter, Anna, who contributed to this edition. Welcome, Anna.
Thanks for having me as well.
I know you're both in the business here, and you've both written about these things. A lot of big ideas to talk to you both about. But can I start with a recipe? Yesterday afternoon, I went to page 277, and I said, I need to make Frankie's feijoada, which was great, and it's crazy filling. I ate it again earlier today, and this is one of the original recipes in the 1971 version, I gather. Francis, why'd you pick this?
For every reason that you're saying, it's tasty, and it fills you up. And so the cool thing was that Anna then took the original recipes and really brought them up to the 21st century.
Yeah, and I have to say, of all the recipes you've chosen, Frankie's feijoada is one of the ones that didn't go through such a facelift or a refresh. A lot of the refresh of the recipes was really looking at all that we've learned about nutrition and plant-centered eating and bringing in a lot more fresh ingredients. And so the recipes that used to have margarine now have butter. The recipes that had some of those 70s ingredients like soy grits no longer have soy grits. So that feijoada recipe is pretty close to the original with a few tweaks around the edges.
Yeah. And Anna, tell me a little bit more about, I guess, what we've learned about certain ingredients, certain food choices. I mean, 50 years later, are there, you know, certain things that might have been great ideas back then, not so much anymore?
Well, I think the huge take home is that as an eater and as someone who wants to eat healthy food, we really don't have to worry and be too preoccupied with our protein sources. And are we getting enough protein? And can we get that protein from the plant kingdom? That's something that is a myth my mom has been battling for 50 years. And I'm delighted to say that I feel like more and more of us understand that the plant kingdom provides ample sources of protein and that we really don't have to overthink it.
And Francis, I guess I want to step back and ask you then, what's the point of having all these recipes in this book? I mean, I gather it goes back to 50 years ago when your publisher said, you know, don't just tell people something, you need to show them too.
Right. Yeah, no, I think the recipes are just so central to the feeling of the book because the book is an invitation to enjoy and to experiment and to be healthier and to really excite people about this way of eating and not thinking of it as giving up, but as embracing.
So here we are. 50 years on, this book is still relevant. Michael Pollan, the author, of course, of The Omnivore's Dilemma, calls this one of the most visionary books of the last 50 years. So, Anna, I'm going to let you gush a little bit about your mom. How do you explain how so many of these ideas went from 1971 counterculture to 2021 mainstream?
What she was saying in 1971 is that our individual food choices and the decisions that we make as nations and really even as a planet around what kind of food we are investing our public dollars in, what kind of food we are celebrating among our most esteemed chefs, that these decisions and these choices have ramifications not just for us individually and our health, but what our ecosystems look like and even what, you know, it is to be a worker in this economy. You know, you think about the mainstreaming of these ideas. You mentioned Michael Pollan. Of course, he sums up, I feel like, my mom's, you know, life's work in 7 words, right? He says, eat food, mostly plants, not too much. That yeah. is an understanding that more and more of us have, as well as understanding that food is a political act. What we eat is a political act. And these choices we make about our food as individuals and societies have such global implications. And I've learned so much from my mother for all the years I've been alive. And it's just really so meaningful for me to have been part of this project to bring this book to a new generation of readers.
And Francis, can you pick up on this phrase? We've heard Anna just say food as a political act.
Yes. I believe that every human being needs to feel that we have power, that we're not powerless, and that our acts have meaning, and that we're connected to others in that meaning. And so what better way to experience that than through food? And I am not powerless. That was what woke me up, because what first just shocked the heck out of me was the incredible waste built into the grain-fed, meat-centered diet. On a worldwide basis, about 80% of the agricultural land, including grazing, goes to livestock, but livestock only give us 18% of our calories. So that's a global picture of the loss. And then to feel the growth of this understanding that this grain-fed, meat-centered diet was driven by this very simple mechanism of what I call a one-rule marketplace that only returns wealth to the wealthy. And so it drove the system that made no sense in terms of our health or people being able to eat or maintaining the agricultural richness. I mean, we've seen just horrific loss of species because of this extensive agriculture to produce meat, and the rainforest in the Amazon, which is the most important rainforest in the world, that 80% of that deforestation there is for, guess what, livestock, and for feed to go to livestock. So I just feel so much that one can feel as an individual very powerless, and to know that what we make decisions about every single day, multiple times a day, can ripple out and help awaken people and start a conversation, right?
But you've also been around the world, and I guess I want to put to you a question that was put to me. I spent a number of years in China, and I went back to my dad's village where people said, you know what, back in the day we ate meat once a year on Chinese New Year. And now in certain parts of China, which, you know, in aggregate is a rich country, but still a lot of poor people who are still catching up to you, the Americans, in meat consumption. Are you telling us that as we're finally getting there, that we can't have this?
Well, I think it's the discovery, the learning that actually this diet that we're the highest per capita meat consumption in the world, that this is actually killing us. I mean, it's not healthy. And so I think the more that we can get this message out about what is a healthy diet. And the beautiful thing is that many indigenous diets for eons and eons have focused in the plant world. And to revalue and to value those traditions is key. I often, you know, notice that this combination of legumes and grains is really throughout the world. And so I'm hoping that the concentration of wealth that is so increasing in our world and in our country today, that I think does contribute to the focus on more meat by those who can afford it. I hope that we can get better at busting that bubble, the idea that somehow if you're better off that you show that through meat consumption, because it is clear that greenhouse gas emissions, you know, 37% of greenhouse gas emissions now come from the food system. And I read this wonderful estimate in a peer-reviewed journal saying that as we change to a plant-centered diet, it would be the equivalent of taking all the cars and trucks and even planes and boats out of the way in terms of saving greenhouse gas emissions. That's the kind of impact it could have.
Yeah. And which takes us back to this new edition of the book and the new recipes. Again, you're showing and you're telling to make your point. And so I want to go to both of you and say, if I'm wanting to move toward a plant-based diet or more plants, less meat, give me your gateway recipe to a plant-based diet.
The dish that popped into my mind first, and now my mouth is watering and I want to make it tonight for dinner, is a pasta recipe by Anthony Mient. And what I love about this recipe is that it is really unexpected flavors coming together. So you have a miso and a shiitake mushroom slurpy topping that goes onto pasta, and then a pickled pepper that you add that gives a nice acidic quality as well. But it's these really fun flavors that I know as a home cook, I would never have thought to put together, that I am so now delighted that I have that taste memory in my, you know, in my mind, thanks to Anthony.
Okay, Frankie, Francis, I'm going to force you to pick one.
Okay, I'm going to pick something that's been in the family for a long time because I remember making it with Anna. I know you know where I'm headed here for, I believe it was Thanksgiving dinner in New York City when you lived in Brooklyn. But anyway, it's called walnut cheddar loaf. I just always loved it. It's really, really simple with walnuts and grated cheddar, and it's got a little lemon in it and some nutritional yeast in it. So you can go with that or not, yeah. Caraway seeds. But I just thought that I would mention that because it brings back happy memories.
We've been talking about the 50th anniversary of the book Diet for a Small Planet with author Frances Moore LePay and her daughter Anna LePay, who has published on this topic as well. Thanks to you both.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.